Beyond Barbarossa, special episode September 2026. A return to the Cold War. Hello, Podiverse. Scott Brewer here in the Redbeard studio with Daisy the Danger Doodle for Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. 81 years ago, a young Russian man brought the Cold War to light. Igor Gruzenko was a cipher clerk working in the embassy of the USSR in Ottawa, Canada. On 5th September 1945, he brought a thick folder of decoded messages to the Canadian Department of Justice. These messages proved a widespread and effective spy network from the Soviet Union at work deep in the strategic organizations in Canada, the United States, and the United Kingdom, essentially throughout the Democratic West. So, a year ago, I set up my recording equipment in the Diefenbunker, Canada's Cold War Museum, just outside Ottawa, to record a special episode about the Gruzenko affair. And I released it on the 80th anniversary of the day that young man tried to warn the democratic world. And as you'll hear, it was not an easy task. Now, as all regular listeners know, Beyond Barbarossa has been tracking the progress of the Second World War's Eastern Front, more or less chronologically, 81 years later. Which means that now, early September 2026, brings us to that time in 1945, when that young cipher clerk brought evidence of Soviet spying on its allies to the disbelieving victims of that espionage. Welcome to another special episode. A rerun of that episode on the start of the Cold War 81 years ago. I take you to the office of the Prime Minister of Canada. Years ago, at about 9 p.m., a handsome blonde man came to the editorial offices of the Ottawa Journal newspaper with a handful of official documents. In halting, heavily accented English, he tried to warn the night editor, one Chester Fowd, about a threat to Western democracies emerging only weeks after the end of the Second World War. Chester Fowd could barely understand the young man. All he could comprehend was the repeated, it's war, it's Russia. Fowd sent him away. The next morning, 6 September 1945, the young man arrived at the offices of the Canadian Department of Justice and asked for the minister, Louis Saint Laurent. With him were his pregnant wife and firstborn son. The family waited for 2 hours until they were told the minister was not available. The family returned to the Ottawa Journal's newsroom, but the editor again declined to see him, fobbing the young family off on a reporter named Leslie Johnstone. The young man translated some of the contents of the documents he carried, and Ms. Johnstone relayed the information to the editor, who told her the paper was not interested. It's extremely ironic, because this young man was Igor Gruzenko, a cipher clerk from Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, assigned to the embassy of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in Canada. With him were his wife, Svetlana, and their son, Andrei. And the documents in his hands were evidence of a major scoop, Soviet espionage in Canada and the USA. On 6 September, the Gruzenkos bounced from the Journal to the Department of Justice again, and then were sent to the Crown Attorney. There, they finally met someone who took them seriously, a woman named Fernande Colson. She began calling contacts with the RCMP, the newspaper, and the federal government, even the Prime Minister's office. But all told her they would not get involved and advised her to send the Gruzenkos away. Dejected, the Gruzenkos returned to their apartment on Somerset Street in central Ottawa
And I put a photo of that apartment building in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. They were terrified that Soviet intelligence would kill them. Neighbors noticed how agitated and fearful they seemed, and Igor explained the situation. One of the neighbors, one Frances Elliott, offered the Guzenkos to stay in her apartment that night. Another, Harold Main, was a corporal with the Royal Canadian Air Force. He offered to contact the police, but the Guzenkos were afraid that their phones had been tapped. So Corporal Main left on his bicycle to ask the local police for help. In the middle of the night, someone pounded on the Guzenkos' apartment door for a long time before giving up. Hours later, a group of men returned. Guzenko watched through his neighbor Francis's keyhole as the men broke into and ransacked his home. But while every arm of the Canadian government and police seemed to be intent on ignoring Guzenko, behind the scenes officials were taking him seriously. On 6 September, the day where he's going between the newspaper and various government departments, two senior officials of the Canadian Department of External Affairs, Norman Robertson and Hume Wrong, were briefing Prime Minister Mackenzie King to tell him about a GRU cipher clerk seeking asylum, afraid of being killed by his government, bearing secret documents. The officials thought the documents should be examined, but Prime Minister Mackenzie King was in the midst of immediate post-war negotiations among the Allies, which of course included the USSR. King did not want a scandal to upset those. If it were up to King, the whole affair would just fade away. But coincidence has a funny way of changing history. It so happened that William Stevenson, the Canadian head of British security coordination during the war, the man called Intrepid, was staying in a swanky hotel in Montebello, not far from Ottawa at this time. And he happened to know, be friends with Norman Robertson, that external affairs official who was trying to brief the Prime Minister and convince him to get their hands on Guzenko's stolen documents. So Norman Robertson asked Stevenson, Intrepid, what he thought. Stevenson's advice, get your man at once. So when the Soviet agents were ransacking Guzenko's apartment, RCF Corporal and neighbor Main called the Ottawa police again. They arrived to confront the men in the Guzenko home, who turned out to be Vitaly Pavlov, head of the Canadian operations of the NKVD, the Soviet Security Service, with three agents. The Ottawa police called the RCMP, who took the Guzenkos into protective custody. By the evening of 7 September, Norman Robertson of External Affairs was briefing the Prime Minister again about just what was in the documents that Igor Guzenko had spirited out of the Soviet embassy. Quote, everything was much worse than we would have believed. The documents disclose an espionage system on a large scale. Not only had U.S. Secretary of State Edward Stettinus been surrounded by spies, etc., and the Russian government had been kept informed of all that was being done from that source, but that things came right into our country to a degree we could not have believed possible. He then told me that they went into our own Department of External Affairs, that in the cipher room there was an agent of the Russians who had seen and knew all our ciphers. The same was true at Earnscliffe, the British High Commission. In the cipher room there, the High Commissioner, the equivalent of ambassadors within the British Commonwealth, Malcolm MacDonald's dispatches were all seen, read, and known. In our research laboratories here at Ottawa, where we had been working on the atomic bomb, there is a scientist who is a Russian agent. In the research laboratories in Montreal, there is an English scientist who is pro-Russian and acting as a Russian agent. End quote. Just point out here that, as was common at the time, people in the West conflated the USSR with Russia. They are two, yes, obviously related, but distinct ideas. Anyway, that same day that that Robertson is briefing the Prime Minister again, the Soviet embassy sent a letter to Canadian External Affairs claiming that Guzenko had stolen money and demanding his arrest. The letter also complained that Vitaly Pavlov and his men from the NKVD had been treated rudely when they were caught ransacking Guzenko's home. Gee, we're sorry. Norman Robertson responded 4 days later, promising the Canadian government would do everything possible to apprehend Guzenko, and even published a fake nationwide bulletin across the country to find him and his family. They moved the Guzenko family around a series of vacation cottages near Ottawa and ultimately settled them at Camp X, the Allies' top secret spy training school near Whitby, a half hour's drive from Toronto. Meanwhile, the RCMP identified a number of Soviet agents implicated in the documents and put them under surveillance. And the Cold War was on. The Diefenbunker was not always a museum. It's a four-story underground bunker built in 1959 in Carp, Ontario, 30 kilometers east of the capital, Ottawa. Originally known as the Central Emergency Government Headquarters, CEGHQ, it was designed to house Canada's Governor General, Prime Minister, Cabinet, and some 500 other important government and military officials for a 30-day lockdown period in the event of a nuclear attack on Canada. This top-secret bunker included sophisticated communications and information networks and could protect the inhabitants from a 5-megaton nuclear blast. As you know, Canada did not suffer a nuclear attack. The bunker became known as Canada Forces Station, or CFS CARP, and was decommissioned in 1994 when the Cold War seemed to be over. The Canadian Armed Forces removed the furniture, equipment, and anything sensitive and sold the facility to the local municipality, CARP. Then a group of volunteers stepped forward and the Diefenbunker, Canada's Cold War Museum, became a reality in 1998. As I mentioned, this bunker included facilities for key members of the government, including fully functional offices for ministers and officials, if small. A meeting room, communications room filled with the latest telecommunications equipment for 1959. Telephones, teletype, radios for every band and more. This included an office for the Prime Minister, with an outer office for an aide, and a bedroom with a single bed. There was no provision for spouses or families. And that's where I am right now, sitting at a desk installed for the Prime Minister of Canada. There's an old black dialed telephone on one side, a mini Olodex or file card holder for contact information, a blotter in the middle, and I've set my recording equipment on top of that. Why am I here? Because today, 5th September 2025, is the 80th anniversary of the day Igor Guzenko revealed to the West, or tried to reveal to the West, just how insidious the USSR was, spying on its allies while those allies were supplying them with the materiel, money, and food it needed to defeat the common enemy, Nazi Germany. If you are wondering why you hear more extraneous noises, maybe voices, and my voice itself sounds more resonant or echoey, well, that's because this is a nuclear bomb bunker. All the walls are concrete and steel. So, yeah, it's not that conducive to recording voice. I put up some, what I hope to be some noise reduction efforts around here, but they can only do so much. So please bear with me. It is a special episode after all. So, who was Igor Guzenko? In 1945, Igor Guzenko was a 26-year-old lieutenant in the GRU, Glavnoye razvedivatelnoye upravlenie, the main intelligence directorate of the Soviet Armed Forces. High academic performance got him noticed, and he was trained as a cipher clerk, coding and decoding messages for the military. He was appointed to the embassy in Ottawa in 1945. So as I said, this is a working museum and there are still visitors coming through. So Igor Guzenko was appointed to the embassy in Ottawa in 1943, bringing along his wife Svetlana. Their first child, Andrei, was born in Ottawa. Okay, so now the sound is going to get a little even more echoey, just because I've taken down most of the sound equipment, sound baffles, just to accommodate the visitors. All right, so Guzenko, who was he? By 1944, Igor Guzenko was getting disillusioned with Soviet life. He was living, after all, in Canada, in conditions that may seem modest here, but were comparatively luxurious for someone born in Russia during its civil war. Canada's election also made an impression on him. He later said that was because elections in the USSR had only one candidate on the ballot. Then, for some reason, he seemed to get into a little bit of trouble in 1944, so a year into his posting in Ottawa. He was recalled to Moscow over some kind of security infraction, or he was ordered to return to Moscow. Igor worried that he could be imprisoned over it, or worse. This was the Soviet Union, after all. Igor's boss, or his supervisor, his superior officer, Colonel Nikolai Zapotin, head of the GRU operations in Canada, managed to get him a reprieve at least until September 1945. So that's almost a year. At some point, the Guzenkos decided to defect, even though they knew that that would put their families still in the USSR at risk. Igor's mother and sister still lived there, presumably so did Svetlana's family. So, yes, we just had a few visitors come by the Prime Minister's office. That was kind of neat. So, we're talking about the Guzenko family. There's different accounts on some of the details on the Guzenko's actual defection. The most likely I found is that for several months, Igor identified certain documents and would mark them by folding the corner or just bending the corner slightly. Then, on 5th September 1945, he collected those documents and left the embassy at the end of his shift. There are different accounts of what he did. Some say he put the papers in a briefcase or satchel of some kind, while others that he shoved them under his coat. However he got them out, he brought them, or tried to bring them, to the newspaper. And that's where we started the episode. So the Cold War was more or less officially on. What was the Cold War, though? Guzenko's revelations made it clear to the West it was at war with the USSR in a new kind of way. And this became known as the Cold War. In researching this episode, I wondered where the term Cold War came from. And when I found out, I thought, of course, where else? George Orwell, author of Animal Farm in 1984, among many other works, wrote an essay in 1945 called You and the Atomic Bomb. Quote, "Few people have yet considered the ideological implications, that is, the kind of worldview, the kind of beliefs, and the social structure that would probably prevail in a state which was at once unconquerable and in a permanent state of Cold War with its neighbors." End quote. So there was a Cold War between the West, led by the United States, and the USSR and its satellites and allies. Allies included Communist China after 1949, and satellites included the European states where Stalin installed puppet communist governments in the countries the Red Army occupied at the end of the Second World War. When did it start? Most historians say the Cold War ended with the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. Many historians trace the origins of the Cold War back as far as the 1917 Russian Revolution that brought the Communist Party to power in Moscow. Because that event laid bare the incompatibility of values between the system that prevailed in the former Russian Empire and the still-forming democracies of the Western world. In the aftermath of the First World War, the Western allies tried to invade Russia to prevent the communists from taking over. They failed. In the interwar years, Moscow worked very hard to export communism to other countries, particularly in Western Europe, and Moscow became the coordinating center for international communism through the Comintern, or Communist International, an organization that by the 1930s was completely under Stalin's control. Winston Churchill, longtime British politician, member of Parliament, first Sea Lord, and Prime Minister of the UK during the Second World War, was a vociferous opponent of communism. He called it, among other things, baboonery. Another opponent of communism was a certain Austrian-born politician named Adolf Hitler. However, his opposition did not prevent him from forming a short-lived alliance with Stalin in 1939 so they could carve up Eastern Europe between them. Then, when Nazi Germany invaded the USSR in 1941, the USSR became an ally of its critic Churchill. He even said, quote, If Hitler invaded hell, I would make at least a favorable reference to the devil in the House of Commons. End quote. As detailed throughout this whole podcast, from that point, the USSR was an ally of the Western powers. The USA, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the rest of the British Commonwealth, the governments in exile of Poland, France, Czechoslovakia, Norway, and also China and India, and others. But the USSR's various spy agencies, the GRU, or Military Intelligence, and the NKVD, the People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs, forerunner to the KGB, or secret police, were already spying on their allies, as well as their enemies. And this never stopped. Now I think it's time for a short break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halbe Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back. During the war, the USSR spied on Britain and the USA's most sensitive operations. For example, Klaus Fuchs was a brilliant scientist who was central to the Manhattan Project, the project that developed the atomic bomb in 1945. Born in Germany in 1911, he joined the Communist Party there in 1932. In 1933, he fled to the United Kingdom after the Nazis' rise to power. There, Fuchs started working in Britain's atomic bomb project. At some point, he began passing information to the Soviets and continued to do so even after moving to the U.S. and Oppenheimer's project at Los Alamos, New Mexico. He was essential to the success of the Manhattan Project, but all along he was betraying the West. There's an excellent podcast about him in Season 7 of the podcast, The Spy Who. I'll put a link in the show notes. He's just one example, but at the end of the Second World War, the USSR had several extensive spy networks operating in all their allied countries, the US, the UK, Canada, In Europe, these supported the establishment, really coups, of communist governments in Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and elsewhere. Communism has always had international ambitions. From the time Lenin took control of the Russian state, even before that, the idea was to spread communism to every country and put control of the economy in the hands of workers, which would be better than having managers in charge, but I digress. When the Allies finally defeated Nazi Germany in May 1945, they divided Austria and Germany into zones of control. The US, UK, France, and the USSR each had an area of Germany and a corresponding section of Berlin. And the same thing in Austria and in Vienna. In their respective zones, they were responsible for policing, order, and providing for the civilian population. But there was a difference between the USSR and the others. Eventually, Britain, France, and the US withdrew their forces and turned the occupied countries over to their local populations. But the USSR held on for decades in eastern Germany and maintained military forces there until 1991. As a result, the country of Germany became divided between the Federal Republic of Germany, or West Germany, with its capital in Bonn, and the German Democratic Republic, in German DDR, with its capital in East Berlin. Because, yes, Berlin itself remained divided between the Western zones, American, British, and French together, and the Soviet. Winston Churchill made another famous speech about this in 1946, and I'm not going to try my Churchill impression, so I'll spare you that. Quote, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all are subject, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and, in many cases, increasing measure of control from Moscow." End quote. The USSR also imposed communist puppet states in Eastern Europe, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Albania, and it kept the once independent countries of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania within the Soviet Union. Yugoslavia, while communist, managed to maintain its independence from both East and West. And throughout the post-war period, the communists continued to pursue their policy of exporting communism across the globe. By 1949, the Western countries responded to the threat of communist expansion by forming the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. This included the UK, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, the United States, Canada, Portugal, Italy, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland. Later, Turkey and Greece joined NATO, and West Germany was allowed to rearm to a certain extent, and it joined NATO in 1955. Now, speaking of 1949, that was the year that the USSR detonated its first atomic weapon using information it had stolen from the West. In response to NATO, the USSR created the Treaty of Friendship, Cooperation, and Mutual Assistance, TFCMA, signed in Warsaw in 1955, which created the Warsaw Pact Organization, or Warsaw Treaty Organization. It was nominally a mutual defense organization of Poland, Bulgaria, Albania, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Romania, and the Soviet Union. But really, it was a Soviet empire. So here we have a division of Europe between East and West, between democracy and authoritarianism. And the whole world began to align in this way, capitalist or communist, left or right. It's important to point out there was a non-aligned movement that said it was part of neither of these blocs. These are countries that refused to follow the lead of either the United States or the Soviet Union. Notably, these included Yugoslavia, India, Indonesia, and the United Arab Republic of Egypt and Syria. But for half a century, world geopolitics was dominated by the division between the nuclear superpowers, the USA and the USSR. Now, I'm just going to give you a few highlights of the Cold War, and this is not by any means comprehensive. summer to autumn of 1946 was the Turkish Straits crisis. Turkey decided not to allow Soviet warships to traverse the Bosporus and Dardanelles between the Black and Aegean Seas, so keeping them locked up in the Black Sea. The USSR protested this and sent the Black Sea Fleet to perform training maneuvers near Turkish shores, and the US responded by sending a task force to Turkey. In January 1947, the USSR interfered, well, that's putting it mildly, they interfered in the Polish election, basically sending in thugs to force an election the way they wanted it and rigging the election as much as possible. The result was a predictably overwhelming communist victory, 80% of the vote. I mean, come on. The new government was really under Moscow's control. Here's one bit of evidence for that. In 1949, Soviet Marshal Konstantin Rokossovsky, one of the main marshals who crushed Germany, moved from command of the Red Army occupation force in Poland to become the country's Minister of National Defense at Stalin's command. In February 1948, the Soviets were again behind a brutal coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia that brought the communists to power there and created the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic. June 1948, the USSR blockaded West Berlin, the exclave of Western interests in the German capital. The West, primarily the US, responded with the famous Berlin airlift to bring vital supplies to the isolated city. On 4th June 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, was born, with 12 countries signing the treaty, as I described. It has since grown to 32 countries, the latest to join being Finland and Sweden. Its goal is to protect Western Europe from attack by the USSR and its puppet states. 29 August 1949, the USSR detonates its first atomic bomb. On 1st October 1949, Mao Zedong's People's Liberation Army defeated the Kuomintang National Government in China, which retreated onto the island of Taiwan and continues to hold it today. The USSR declared an alliance with Communist China. In response, the US extended its policy of containment of communism to include Asia, Africa, and Central and South America. June 1950, Communist North Korea attacked South Korea, sparking the Korean War, also known as the United Nations War. The USSR and China supplied and supported the North, while the West, particularly the US, Canada, Britain, and other nations under the United Nations banner, supported the South. In 1950, Dwight Eisenhower, previously the Supreme Commander of Western Allied Forces during the war, was elected President of the United States. He escalated U.S. defense spending, and the containment policy grew to be largely dependent on nuclear bombs. The age of MAD, mutually assured destruction, begins. 1953, the death of Stalin, as hilariously described in the movie of the same name. It eventually brought Nikita Khrushchev to power. He criticized Stalin in a famous speech, but did not change the Soviet strategy of communist expansion, oppression, or military buildup. May 1955 was the time the Warsaw Pact was proclaimed by the USSR, including its puppet states of Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. Everywhere it has installed communist governments by force. 1956, an anti-communist uprising in Hungary brought about savage Soviet reprisals, including thousands of tanks, leading to one of the most oppressive communist regimes in Eastern Europe for another half century. 1956 was an important year. That was the year the Chinese and Soviet communists split. Mao called Khrushchev an upstart, and the Soviet leader called Mao a lunatic. On 1st January 1959, Fidel Castro's and Che Guevara's communist revolution took power in Cuba, and bringing the perceived threat of communism very close to American shores. 1961, Berliners wake up to find a wall dividing their city with barbed wire and machine guns, and basically hemming them in. 1962, the USSR begins installing nuclear missiles and launchers in Cuba. The Americans respond with escalating threats. The Cuban Missile Crisis is the closest we've come to that mutually assured destruction. But it would not be the last time we approached it. 1963, increasing political instability in South Vietnam pulls the U.S. to embed more and more military advisors in the country's armed forces. Tensions mount with communist-aligned North Vietnam. the situation, the Vietnam War, yet undeclared, gets worse through the decade, and it's the bloodiest yet undeclared war between communism and capitalism, which is a massive oversimplification. But anyway, it lasts until the U.S. withdraws in humiliation in 1975. 1968 is the Prague Spring. Alexander Dubček was elected first secretary of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, and his government began a program of liberalizing reforms, like increased freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and more. The USSR did not like this, so along with its Warsaw Pact puppets, it sent 165,000 soldiers and 4,600 tanks into the country. They installed the compliant Gustav Husák as the new first secretary, and a new government rolled back all the reforms and tightened oppression even more. As many as 300,000 citizens fled the country. Through the 1970s, there was an ebb and flow of détente between the U.S. and USSR, West and East, attempts to ease the tensions, including talks to reduce nuclear weapons. But then in 1979, the USSR invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. funded and armed the Mujahideen resistance, which led to the formation of the Taliban. In its 10 years in Afghanistan, the USSR lost more than 50,000 soldiers. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States. He called the USSR an evil empire and, along with UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, hardened opposition to the Soviet Union and to communism. Reagan increased military spending again. Tensions increased. In 1981, the Polish Solidarity Trade Union movement began protesting and striking for better workers' rights, particularly in the Gdansk shipyards. The Polish Communist government cracked down, but Solidarity would prove to be unstoppable. 1 September 1983, the Soviet Air Force shot down a Korean Airlines 747 which had accidentally strayed into Soviet airspace en route from Anchorage, Alaska to Seoul, Korea. All 269 aboard died, including a sitting U.S. member of Congress. In 1985, after the deaths of two successive octogenarian leaders, Mikhail Gorbachev became General Secretary of the USSR. He began wide-ranging reforms to improve the economy, including perestroika, or rebuilding, and glasnost, or openness. That is, greater toleration for dissent and a little bit of free speech. The USSR even allowed rock and roll bands to tour. 12 June 1987, in a speech before the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, U.S. President Ronald Reagan demanded of new Soviet General Secretary, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. 1989 was the so-called Pan-European Picnic, revolution, some peaceful, some not, among the Warsaw Pact countries. Poland and Hungary held competitive elections. The Velvet Revolution put novelist Václav Havel in charge in Czechoslovakia. The communist government in Bulgaria fell. But it would take a violent uprising and execution of President Nicolae Ceausescu to end communism in Romania. Finally, in November, thousands of protesting East Germans, with help from thousands of people in West Berlin, tore down the Berlin Wall. The East German government fell, and without opposition from Moscow, the divided Germany began a process of reunification. In August 1991, communist hardliners in Moscow, opposing reforms, arrested Gorbachev and sent the army into the streets. The people rose up in protest and the army turned against the communist coup leaders. Very shortly, the coup was over. Boris Yeltsin, president of the Russian Federation, the biggest part of the USSR, declared Russian ownership of Soviet property. By the end of the year, the USSR is no more. The Cold War is over. Or is it? Those are just a few highlights of the Cold War. What I've given in just a few minutes is a massive oversimplification of a 50-year conflict and tension that spanned the globe.
Thank you for listening to this special re-podcast of Beyond Barbarossa, where we went beyond the Second World War and into the beginning of the Cold War. As always, you can find photos about this episode on the website beyondbarbarossa.ca, where you can also listen to the episode. And you can also listen to it on my own website, writtenword.ca. Just click on the podcast button in the banner. I want to thank all who support this podcast through Patreon until Ukrainian people can return home safely. Your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. If you like this episode, please follow Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. If you have a moment, I'd love it if you'd give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, Pocket Casts, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen. That really helps spread the word to others interested in history. Do you have something to say? An interesting fact to share, a comment, or a question to ask? I love hearing from listeners. Reach me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. Morse code sound effects by Dane Brown. Everything else was done by me, Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, Viva Canada.